It's Channel 2 Right. And Debbie and Rick report on Friday after supper, the 8th of December, 72, Channel 2 Right, and beginning of the visit, Debbie and Rick report Friday after supper, the 8th of December, 72, Channel 2 Right, Debbie and Rick report Friday after supper, the 8th of December, 72, Channel 2 Right, Rick and Debbie report Friday after supper, the 8th of December, 72.
You never get in the same kind of goodwill.
Yeah, I did. I got some really beautiful old clothes from Goodwill one time.
Actually worked?
Yep, they actually worked. They were beautiful. Hey, I got a the play that we were doing was supposed to be 1930s, and I played the mother, and I had to wear all these sort of suits and things, you know, that people wore in 1930. And I got this really beautiful suit from Goodwill. It was white linen, and it came down about, you know, just above my ankle.
Yeah.
Had the big padded shoulders and what did they call the lapels that came out in the wide lapels, Chesterfield lapels, but came almost out to the shoulder, and then the shoulder pads like that.
Yeah.
Little white jacket, and then the top of it was orange and white silk.
Mm.
It was a beautiful thing. It really was. We almost didn't give it back to them.
Oh, you just borrowed it.
No, we bought all the costumes from Goodwill.
Yeah.
We used them in the play, and then we gave them back for them to resell, saying that what it cost us, that we just donate the money for buying them, sort of like renting them. We got all the costumes for the whole play, everybody's.
But you attempted to keep that white suit.
Uh-huh. My mother and I were going to take it apart and use the linen.
Oh.
Because the skirt was so long. The skirt went from your waist almost down to your ankle, the length that skirts were in 1930.
Hmm.
And there was enough material in it to make another dress. But we gave it back.
You just weakened.
Yes, our conscience has bothered us, our collective consciousness.
Well, I don't think it was that. I think it was just your industry.
Our laziness took over.
Well, now, you knew what you were going to town for.
Yes, I went in to see a play at the Little Theater. And yes, it was like interesting. Front Page, name of it, Front Page, about newspapermen in the 20s, which is why we actually got off talking about those costumes last night, because the costumes in this play were 1920, and the real wide lapels on the suits, all the newspapermen. And it's a funny play. It's about and newspapermen waiting up all night for a hanging. They're watching the hanging out the window of the press room. And at the end of the first act, the convict escapes, breaks prison, and of course jumps onto the roof of their building and comes in the window of the press room with one of the reporters in there alone. And he immediately hides him in the roll top desk and calls. calls his editor and says, "I've got the convict. I said it's the biggest story we've had all year. I've got the murderer in the desk here." And so the editor comes down to the man in the roll top desk, "You're our property. We're just going to keep you. We'll get some men from the paper to come, and we'll just take the desk out." And the little reporter says, "How are you going to do that? How are you going to walk out of here with a desk?" And the editor says, "Well, it's perfectly easy. If we can't walk out the door, we'll lower it out the window." And the whole time, this poor man, for two acts, the actor is stuck in this desk. And it was deceiving, because you didn't realize when you looked at the desk that it really was big. And it was a fabulous old desk with the roll top that came down, you know, and the little narrow slats up, and then lots and lots of drawers down the side, and when the roll top was up, that whole inside of it was just all these little cubby holes and drawers and places to stick envelopes and paper. Oh, fantastic desk, and big enough for a man, a tall man, to get in, lie down, and have them roll the top down. And he spent the two acts in there.
We thought this like that.
We kept thinking, how in the world is he breathing in there?
Well, that was the Gainesville Players.
Little theater, yes. Yeah. It was a good production.
Well, who do you know that takes part in that?
Well, David Lane, we know.
Oh, he's still there.
Yeah, he was the editor. And then my sister knows, is very good friends with the wife of one of the young men who acts in there a lot. And we actually went sort of to see him. He was one of the newspaper reporters. But this was a very large cast. It was about 25 people in the cast, and they had to really recruit a lot of people that had never acted before. Because in the castles in the program, they kept saying, "Mr. So-and-so is making his stage debut with the Gainesville Little Theater," and then you'd read another castle, and it would say, "Miss So-and-so is making her stage debut with the Gainesville Little Theater." Half the cast had never done anything before. They did a good job. Nobody dropped lines.
Well, Edward just commented.
Was like, it's also that you see everyone get manipulated and manipulate back. The newspaper men manipulate the people that they write stories about, and there's a prostitute in it, and they're very mean to her, and she's supposed to be the murderer who escapes are the most manipulated people. But then, as the reporters manipulate them, the mayor of Chicago and the sheriff of Chicago are also manipulating all the reporters. But the production emphasized the comedy rather than I suppose you could say the tragedy of it. It was lighter.
Well, I don't see much beginning for that.
Oh, I've had a light few days, just light and frothy. Haven't used my mind a bit, just frothy. Foam on the ocean top.
Is that great?
Venus out of the sea foam.
What?
Today was the best of all. Today they got me for the Gainesville Daily Sun. Got me.
But you didn't. I thought that's what you went in for.
No, I went in to see this play. I was supposed to have written these book reviews 2 weeks ago. I went. The first time, when I went back into Gainesville after the first time I was out, we went to a cocktail party, and I walked in, and I was accosted with the idea that, since I read so fast, my sister has been spreading rumors, that I could read a book and write a book review about it. And I said, well, I've never written a book review before in my life. It certainly is a shot in the dark to ask me to write a book review. I've barely even written a book report. So my sister is so upset, right? She's worried all day yesterday. She kept calling up to me and saying, it's all right, you know, I hope you can get it done.
She did, too.
She felt personally responsible, so she went around cutting out book reviews out of the paper and giving them to me. She gave me a sheet of them, and she gave me one from the New York Times, and she said, this one is class. Read this one, it's classy. Oh, dear. So, I was supposed to have read these two books and written reviews on them 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago. And when I called my mother yesterday, she said, have you written those book reviews? And I said, well, no, I haven't. Maybe I could read the book tonight and write the review tomorrow. And somehow everyone seemed to think that was a little shoddy that I should spend a week doing it. So I sat down this morning at 9 o'clock and I read the book and I got up and about 11 and I tried to think of everything I could do to not have to write the book report. So I washed some clothes and then some friend of my mother's came by and so I
Claire Stryker
came by and she wanted to tell me about her sick cat. And so she sat down and told me about the sick cat and we had coffee. And then I said, oh good. I said to her as she came up the walk, I'm so glad you're here. I don't have to write my book review, which I shouldn't have done because my mother said what you should do is just let people think you've been carrying it around with you out in heaven. And see, they think it's shoddy that I haven't written, that I didn't spend all week writing this. See, that I sat down and wrote it this afternoon. That's not good enough just to sit down and read the book and write the book review. I should have spent a lot of time on it. So.
Well, I must say, you have lost face out here a time or two by producing masterpieces in 30 minutes, you see. They were mighty good up until we found out it just took 30 minutes.
That's right. I remember how Debbie wrote this in 30 minutes. It couldn't be this good.
Well, I wouldn't pass off any comments about this until you see my byline.
Well, at least she's going to be in print.
No, they're going to print it.
But you don't know when.
Week from Sunday.
Oh, that's a big time.
That's the only time they print book reviews in the Gainesville Daily Sun. It's not a daily occurrence.
Well, you had two literary events. You were just full of literary events.
Weren't they literary, yes. A book review and a play.
All in the same 24 hours.
All in the same 48 hours.
48 hours.
Oh, and even better than that. Oh. When I went to campus, yesterday, was it?
Yeah.
I left my things in Guy's office and I went across. I was going to say hello to my father. And I walked up, he wasn't in his office, so I wrote out a little note and I stuck it under the door that I'd been by, and a friend of his walked by and I said, you know, have you seen my father? And he said, well, I think he was heading over toward the library, why don't you hang around a minute? So I did, and another professor came out and with an open book like this, and I just could see all these people walking around in that building with open books, and she walked up and was talking about this poem by William Carlos Williams.
That Professor Bloodworth?
No, it wasn't. I only met Professor Bloodworth 2 weeks ago. I wouldn't hang around to say hello to her. She's not a close friend. And I was going to wait and say hello to this woman. And she turned around and saw me, and she said, oh, Debbie, you're just... Hello, how are you? I didn't know you were back in town. Would you analyze this poem for me? And I said, what? She said, I want you to read this. I'm having a little trouble with the interpretation of this poem. Will you sit down and read it and tell me what it's about? And I said, well, I thought it was by William Carlos Williams, so I thought I would take refuge in the fact that I didn't know anything about him. And I said, I don't know anything about William Carlos Williams. I better not read it. And she said, it doesn't matter. Read it anyway. So just sit down right there. And there was a chair in the hall. She said, sit down and read it. Pointed to the chair. So I sat down in the chair and I read the poem once and then I read the poem twice and then I thought, well, I'd do it really proud and I read it three times. And then I got up and I went into her office and I said, well, I think it's about this.
What did you think it's about?
Well, it's about yachts. It's about boats in the sea.
You know it's not about boats. William Carlos Williams not going to write about a boat.
Well, I thought it was about a yacht, and I told her that I thought it was about a yacht in the sea, and she said, well, that's what she thought, too, but she had a student who thought it was all about socialism and the Red Army and the White Russians, and I said, well, maybe it was. I didn't know anything about William Carlos Williams, but I thought it was about ships in the sea. And then she let it go at that. And then she said, well, what are you doing with yourself now? And I said, nothing. And she said, fine, I'm glad to hear it. And then she said, she went babbling on about the movie The Graduate, where the boy graduates from college and goes back to his family, and his family says, just take your time, just take your time, decide what you want to do, but I think you better get a job in 2 weeks. And I thought, well, it's been 3 years now. Maybe someday I'll make up my mind. And at that point, when she started talking about the graduate, I stood up and tried to leave.
You thought she might be personal?
It was getting to be more than I was afraid she'd make me read another poem. I wasn't going to hang around. That's funny. First thing that happened to me when I walked onto the university campus, somebody asked me to analyze a poem.
Telling you
I'm in the
university.
You don't believe them. Well, that was a 48 hours.
That was a 48 hours, yes. That was.
Well, now, is that what you call an outing?
Well, it was refreshing. Frothy, you know, refreshing. I enjoyed it. I could see the humor in being asked to look at a poem. My problem is I always see the humor in everything. It's hard for me to be serious.
You didn't see your family at all.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, not too much, because I didn't see my sister and my father too much. We went to the play last night, and we had a guest for dinner, so we didn't get too much chance to talk, except my sister was worried that I wasn't going to get the book review written. But my mother and I today, my mother and I have a ritual when we are together that, well, first of all, we both laugh a lot, and we manage to laugh at things that no one else thinks is funny, but my mother and I laugh until we cry, which is just something that happens when we're together. And usually we start laughing when we play two-handed bridge all the time when we're together. If we at any given time during the day, my mother will say, well, I think we have time for a hand, and we'll sit down and we'll play two-handed bridge. But what you have to understand about us playing two-handed bridge is that every game is the same, and there's so much the same that we can't even remember from hand to hand who shuffled the cards and who's supposed to draw first. So we sit down and play this game after game after game of two-handed bridge, but we say the same things to each other. It's a real ritual. I looked at it that way today because we played cards right after lunch, and then for played about three hands about 4 o'clock. Just, you know, any time during the day when my mother feels the need to sit down and play a few hands of cards, she'll say to me, "Time for a hand." And we'll play two-handed bridge, but we'll draw. We'll start out drawing the cards. My mother always the way you play two-handed bridge is you draw. Each person draws 2 cards, and then you discard one. So you end up with 13 cards as you're supposed to have in bridge, and you also have this pile of cards left over. My mother invented a new rule. This time when I came home, she just told me she'd thought up a new rule, and the new rule was that whoever won the bid could look in that pile and take what card they wanted. So if somebody's thrown away an ace, you could get it back. And today, she told me she certainly was glad she thought up that rule. Well, then we start playing. My mother always, with my mother, the first 2 cards she takes, another of my mother's rules is that you can, at one point during the draw, you can keep 2 cards. You don't have to throw one away. You can, if you get draw 2 aces, you can keep them both. But you can only do it once in the hand. And so my mother always keeps the first 2 cards she draws, always, so that she has a card to work with for the rest of the hand. And I say to her, well, what happens if you get cards later on in your hand that you want to throw away? And she doesn't understand that logic, because she said, well, then you just throw away the first card that you kept, which gets you awfully snarled up. But anyway, she always keeps the first 2 cards, and then, well, she'll draw and she'll keep the first 2 cards, and I'll draw and I usually throw away the first card. And then by the third draw, she's looking at me and saying, do you have all the high cards yet? And I'll say, No, not yet. But what you have to understand is that we say the same things in every game. The same things. It's true, we do. I watched it today, and we say the same things to each other. But it's hysterically funny because we laugh all the time while we're playing. We know we're saying the same things to each other. We know we're not going to remember when we get to the end. It doesn't matter who wins. The only thing, it only matters, sort of the gross score matters. My mother will total up the scores and she'll say, well, I'm 10,000 ahead of you. And she keeps the score pads. Every time I come home, this has been going on for about the last 5 years, and I'll come home once a year and she'll get out the score pad from the last time I was home, and we'll sit down and play again. She'll say, well, you've got 2 weeks to make up that 10,000 points you're behind. And one year when I was home for vacation from college, I got really far ahead of her. I was about 15,000 points ahead. And she said, well, Debbie, for a Christmas present, I'm going to tear up the score. You don't have to come back next summer and face. It's kind of emotional release, I guess. Because it's mostly just a good occasion for us to sit down and laugh.
Well, I didn't know your mama was like that. I thought Phoebe, your sister Phoebe, was like that. Because every time I have seen her, I've seen her very few times, and I really never talked to her. But she always had a very bright look on her face and just grinning.
She's like that, but she doesn't laugh like my mother does. And I laugh like my mother. We just laugh to the point of crying. I mean, when I laugh, I cry too, because I get just carried away. And my mother's the same way. And the trouble is, you see, that we start laughing and we can't stop. When we start laughing together, we can't stop. And no one else in the room will ever be able to understand it. And my father will kind of look down his nose. My sister will hold her head like this. And my mother and I will weep at the dinner table over just idiotic things. I mean, it's never anything that's terribly funny.
And they have to put up with that.
And they have to put up with it, yes.
Well, when Phoebe gets so serious,
she's not terribly serious, but she just does it. She just doesn't laugh quite as in such a lunatic manner as my mother and I do.
Well, she's still.
Oh, she's very funny, Phoebe watches people. She knows more about more people than anybody. She really does. She didn't happen to know people the other day when we had lunch with her, but the people who
she
would know
had
about.
Her mind on something else.
She was talking about computers, and I think she wasn't quite sure what we were asking, partially. But she knows, she keeps everybody, she's sort of like, she knows everybody that's getting married and everybody that's getting divorced, and she sort of keeps all the, you know, she has all of Gainesville under her hat, sort of, you know, she knows where, just what everybody's doing, and she'll tell you about it, right? It's, her big news is who's been divorced this month, or who's getting married, or who had what kind of baby, and that. She's real good with that kind of news. Not that that's the only thing she talks about, but she really has a capacity for memorizing things like that.
How did she get into that?
I don't know.
She didn't get that at Duke, did she?
Smith.
She didn't go to Duke, she went to Smith.
She didn't get that at Smith. And she didn't get it from your mama.
No, I don't know where she picked that up. I don't know where she picked that up. No, my father doesn't even remember people's names.
He won't admit it.
He does it on purpose. He's so funny. He gets things just enough off so that it sounds like what it's supposed to sound like, but it's not right. Like someone on campus, Bill Ormond, is that right?
Will
Ormond. Well, my father calls him Bill Altman, which is enough like Will Arman, but I can't call him anything but Bill Altman. And then, you know, the movie The Godfather that came out?
Oh, no.
My father goes around calling it The Grandfather. Which is almost The Godfather, but not quite. So I have to catch myself when I talk about that. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know anything about it, but I have to catch myself when I talk about it. I don't call it The Grandfather. Instead of The Godfather. He used to, when we were growing up, he used to do it to tease us. He'd never remember our friends' names, which is when you're in your teens. It's just terrible if your parents don't remember your friends' names, or they called Jean Betty and Betty Alice and Alice Suzanne and run down the list like that and get them all confused or mix up the last names. They don't get
that's
the right.
So embarrassing.
And you just get mortified when you're 14 years old and you bring home your best friend that week and your father calls her by the name of your best friend from last week. And he used to do it on purpose just to aggravate us. I think.
Well, where did he get that?
That's
he got that from you all, didn't he? From just teasing you all.
I think so. From teasing us.
Yeah.
Teasing us, yes.
And he works it on us, too.
On everybody, on students, too. He calls the students all the wrong names.
Well, what else does Phoebe... She does a little of everything, doesn't she?
She knows movies and theater. She likes movies and theater a lot, and she knows as much.
So you can keep up with it.
All I have to do is All I have to do is listen to her because she knows all about it, and she knows all about all the old movies, the film history, and who were the great directors of 25 years ago and things like that. And so I really just have to listen to her, and I know, or listen to her, and I know who's good now and who I should go and see. And she's my built-in movie critic. I just go ask her what movies I should be seeing. Or that's another thing she says when she sees me after when I come home and I haven't been home for a while. She'll say, there's just nothing, no good movies on in Gainesville this week. No good movies on in Gainesville this week. And she'll get discouraged. If there's a good movie on, we'll go and see it.
Yeah.
We always go. If there are a lot of good movies in one week, we'll go to all of them.
Oh, really? Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. All of them in one week. When I was here down here in August, we went to where there were a lot of good movies, and we went to two or three movies a week for the month I was home. It's all the movies I saw all year, practically.
So you came back from...
from France and saw movies.
And you didn't see a movie in France?
I saw a couple, yes. But I saw one American movie translated into French. And then I saw a French documentary on the Algerian War that I didn't understand all of. And I saw Charlie Chaplin. They reissued all of Charlie Chaplin. I saw that. Oh, and I saw an American movie in Paris, but that was in English. So it didn't count. And I saw a Charlie Chaplin movie on the plane coming back. That was when the people, you have to buy the earphones to listen to the movie on the plane. And they came by selling the earphones, and they said, well, I was late getting on the plane. I almost missed the plane coming back because I flew from Germany to London, and then I had to get on the plane in London to come here to get to Boston, and the plane was late, an hour late getting to London, and so I only had about 30 minutes to make my flight, and I thought I was never going to make it at all. And I went to I didn't even know that you could land in a country and not go through customs and take off again. I thought I had to go through customs in England and then go out again, go into the country and come out and leave. But fortunately, I saw the sign that said through passengers, and I went up to the desk and I said, I have a flight in 30 minutes on TWA, can you get me on it? And they said, sure, and they called, the TWA people sent a car around, picked me up and zipped me under, it was wild rides, zipping under the bottoms of planes and in and out, and got me to my plane on time, and I went running up the service entrance on the back of the plane and got on about 10 minutes before the plane took off. But I happened to sit in the section I didn't know that had a Charlie Chaplin movie, and the stewardess came around and said, "Is Charlie Chaplin movie playing? City Lights, or whatever. I think it was City Lights." Yeah. And I hadn't seen it, and so I got terribly excited. Oh boy, this is great! She came around selling earphones. I bought some right away. You know, $2.50. I was so excited. I didn't care if it was $2.50. And I was waiting for the movie like this, and then as I was opened my package of earphones and was ready to put them on, the man sitting next to me turned around and said, "You know, it's a silent movie." And I said, "Oh, that's right, isn't it?" I've wasted my $2.50, and so I decided I'd get even with him because he'd made a fool of me. He had pointed out before the movie even started that it was a silent movie, which I should have known. And so I sat through the whole movie, and they had music. So you could hear the music in between the scenes, and every time the music would come on, I'd hit him in the ribs and say, "Hi, there's music now." And 7 hours, you get to be very good friends with the people sitting next to you on either side. We had wonderful conversations coming back and forth. Cross. Oh, how did we get off on movies?
You and Phoebe going to the movies.
Oh, Phoebe and I going to the movies. I just thought of something else about that. Phoebe has always gone. I've always gone to the movies with Phoebe. Ever since I was little, gone to the movies with Phoebe, because Phoebe has always liked to go to movies. And when she was young, she used to get an allowance of 30 cents a week. And that was when movies cost 9 cents or 10 cents or something like that. And Phoebe budgeted her 30 cents so that she could go to all the movies in town. That was when the state and the Florida, well, the state isn't even up anymore, but Florida and the state was on University Avenue too. And those were the only two theaters in town, and Phoebe would go to both of them 3 times a week. But my mother said, you can't go to the movies alone. She wouldn't let her go alone. She didn't want her to get into the habit of going to the movies alone. You have to take somebody with you. Ha ha. Who'd she take with her? Little sister. She would pay me to go to the movies with her. And I went to all the movies with her. I don't remember any of them. The only thing I remember about going, I was very young. I must have been 5. All I can remember is walking. We used to live on 9th Avenue. And we'd walk to the state in the Florida. It was just 6 or 7 blocks. And we'd walk down the train tracks that went by the thing. And Phoebe was very tall. She grew to her present height when she was in about the 5th grade. She was 5'8 in the 5th grade, and I was not very tall. And I can remember she would walk down the train tracks, and I would run behind her. And I could never keep up with her because she was so tall, and she would just go striding off down the train tracks. And I can just remember running behind her trying to keep up with her, and never remembering a single movie that we went to see, not one, except when we did go to see a horror movie one time that scared the hell out of me, and I had nightmares. I had terrible nightmares that night, and after that, my mother said that I couldn't go to any more horror movies, and she wouldn't even let Phoebe go because I had had such bad dreams about this from this movie.
Phoebe paid you.
Phoebe paid me to go. She paid my way in, and occasionally she'd treat me to something to eat. That was a little bait. Keep me going. And she could never get Susan to go. Susan was much, much too strong-willed. She'd never do that. But I'd do anything either one of them told me to do.
Susan must have been really something.
Susan was a holy terror, yes. Susan used to bawl my parents out because they weren't bringing her up properly. Her first story was when she was about 3. My mother took Phoebe and Susan and some other children to see The Wizard of Oz. And they went to the drive-in. It was the first movie they'd seen. And my sister Susan was terrified of the Wicked Witch of the West, who has green face and flies around with wild music and tries to get Dorothy and the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodsman and the Cowardly Lion all the time, and at one point carries off the dog. And my sister was so terrified of the Wicked Witch of the West that the whole trip home from the drive-in, she sat in the back seat and said to my mother, loudly, "What a terrible movie to take little children to. You should not take little children to a movie like that. You just should not. They might be frightened." My mother just let her talk. And then the next thing when Susan bawled my parents out was in our religious upbringing. Susan, at the age of 12, decided that she was going to be confirmed because everybody in her Episcopal Sunday school class was being confirmed. She went to her first communion class, confirmation class, and she discovered that in order to be confirmed, you had to be baptized. And it transpired that none of us were baptized. So Susan came home from her first confirmation class, and she sat my mother down, and she said, "Why aren't we baptized like everybody else? What's wrong with you that you didn't baptize us?" At this point, my sister Phoebe had not been to church since she was about 6. She gave it up at an early age. Susan and I had gone rather regularly, but with my father taking us to church, leaving us, we went to the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church by Wilson's, and he would leave us at Wilson's to go to Sunday school. He would park the car right in front of the door, of the front door, and then he would walk down to Mike's bookstore, buy a Sunday paper, talk to Mike for a while, buy some cigarettes, walk back up and sit in the car in front of the front door of the church and read the Sunday paper and smoke a cigarette, waiting for us to come out. Well, and wearing his habitual Sunday garb, which was just a nice flannel shirt. And it used to mortify me. I would come out from Sunday school, and everybody else's fathers would have gone to Sunday school with them, and my father would be reading the Sunday paper in the car. He didn't even have the decency to park around the corner. He parked in front of the church. Well, as you can see, our parents were not too distressed that we weren't baptized, but my sister Susan was terribly upset that we weren't baptized. So she told my mother, said that this, we've got to do something about this because I want to be confirmed, and I'm not going to be baptized all by myself at age 12. I'm too old. I've got to have some company. So she got it all worked out that all three of us would have this triple baptism. I was 9, Phoebe was 15, and Susan was 12. And we went through with it. My mother decided that she could get out of it. She could save face as a mother with Susan by telling her that since she was so old, that the reason she wasn't baptized until she was so old was that she could then pick her godparents. See, most people were so unlucky that they got baptized when they were infants and they couldn't pick their godparents. But we, the Bowers girls, were so lucky. We were old enough to pick our godparents. My mother was really quick on her feet with Susan.
And it worked out
because she said, "Now what you can do is all three of you can sit down and write on a piece of paper who you want your godparents to be." And so we did, and we all three picked Phoebe Florey. And that's
three.
How Phoebe Florey came to be our godmother.
All three of you?
All three of us did. And we also have another set of godparents, too.
Luxury.
That's luxury. That's extra. But we got this all down. And our other set of godparents actually are the Strikers, Claire and David Stryker. And I think the reason for that was that David was at that point playing the organ in the Holy Trinity. And I think my mother thought, well, she better get somebody who was an Episcopalian in there singing for us, because she and my father certainly didn't know anything about the church. And she figured David did because he sat through the services every week.
But he was.
We went through with this triple baptism. We all got dressed up in white dresses, and we went down, and we got, I distinctly remember standing around the baptismal font, all three of us, Phoebe 5'8", towering over the minister. We all got baptized, and my sister proceeded to get confirmed, and I eventually got confirmed also, now being endowed with a baptismal certificate. And promptly left the church after my confirmation class.
Well, that's a little hard to believe. Phoebe didn't. I mean, Susan didn't.
Susan stayed on. She stayed on in church for a long time. She was by far the most religious of the three of us. But,
Well, religious is not necessarily.
Well, no. She liked Sunday school.
Yeah.
She had good Sunday school teachers, and she liked Sunday school.
Yeah.
And I didn't particularly care for Sunday school. I enjoyed confirmation classes. They were fun. They were, and I used to sing in the choir with David Stryker too. I liked that when I was in third and fourth grade.
Oh, really?
I liked that a lot because you got to wear robes and walk down behind the cross.
Well, that gave you a feeling for the boys and sharks. Did it?
A little bit.
Wouldn't
yeah.
Hurt, would it?
Yeah.
Well, what happened to all of you Sunday school?
Well, we started out Presbyterians. My mother was a Presbyterian, and my father was Episcopalian. And we started out in the Presbyterian church. My mother sent us there. And then my father's aunt found out that we weren't being brought up Episcopalians. And she was very distressed, and she wrote my father a letter, and she said she didn't understand why he wasn't bringing his girls up Episcopalians, because he'd been brought up as an acolyte and all of that, and she didn't understand why he was falling down in his duty to his girls. And I guess to appease her, they switched Sunday schools, and we started going to the Episcopal Sunday school. And Phoebe didn't want to switch. She wanted to stay. All her friends were at the Presbyterian Sunday school, so she just gave up church altogether. She stopped going because she didn't want it. She didn't want Susan and I to be going to one church and she going to another church. And she didn't want to go to the Episcopal church, so she just stopped going altogether. And Susan and I switched, willing victims of Aunt Madge, and were eventually baptized and confirmed.
So you are just irreligious now. You know, I've tried several times in my life to be religious, and I managed for a year or two at a time. It's almost like somebody hooked on tobacco or something like that. See, I have to go back to it every now and then, but I can't stay. It's so dull.
What I liked about the Episcopal Church was that the pageantry, and that's what I like about Catholicism too. Is that it's a pageant to watch, and for me that's a lot of what religion is.
You see, what I missed out on, I spent several years over there in Sunday school and church in Micanopy, and all I got out of it was just flat-headed, that's all. Now Rick goes over there to the town council for a couple of months, and he got more out of that, you see, than I did out of all the Sunday school. Everybody I got in with over there, and there were dozens of people I got in with over there, it just led nowhere. I just couldn't make anything out of it. I couldn't. And here he goes over there, Wade, and they just set a record in that town council. We got some tapes of it and all like that. and it's just, you just see people in action in that. Including people who never came to church. They were on the road, but they didn't come. Well, anyhow, I don't know. It makes me wonder. I don't know. How it is. But all those movies. But none of them in French. Well, there was so much else going on. You didn't have Phoebe over there to tell you.
I didn't have Phoebe to tell me which movies I was supposed to go to.
That makes a difference, doesn't it?
It does.
When she was in France with you, you didn't get to move it.
No, we didn't. She wasn't, she was only there 2 weeks and we did.
Can she ride a horse?
Phoebe? She rides UB. she did. Here she came out. The time she was out here, she went riding on Yubi. Yeah. She was the first one that went horseback riding before Susan and I took it up. She used to go when she was really young, when we lived in St. Petersburg. And then and she didn't stop.
Well, you know, Debbie, you are circumstantial about all these things in a very nice, a remarkable way. And you know what I think of is the great loss. You see, that has been a part of the C3 thing over there. And they've had some pretty, pretty lively spirits in that. Orman in his time was not bad. And he's slowed down since he had those detachments and all. Retina. When I came here, he was pretty lively, and all those other fellas. There's a large number of them that Jake Wise brought here, doing all sorts of things. See old Bob Lee and all of them. Just one sort of screwball after another. And you know, there's not anyone to be the chronicler of them. None of them. And I bring it up every now and then. I ask old Freddie Guillen, you know. Freddie has a nice touch. Mm-hmm. He's also got blood pressure now. And he almost killed himself, you know, with emphysema and smoking and all those things. But even so, I don't see any effort or any inclination to preserve it. Now, I wouldn't call that local history. I mean, that's not history. That's not oral history. And it's other sort of history. That's just they could get together and talk. You can set it down, and or you can tape it, or anything you want to do. Jake is the only person I ever saw who had staff meetings that were exciting. Jake Wise. Now, he's a scoundrel. He's a scoundrel of the first water. There's no doubt about it. But there's so many things that he did that were interesting. And he kept it going.
And there were a lot of spirits in that.
Oh, yes. And furthermore, that anthology they get out is, I've been reading that, you see, for the last 10 or 15 years, and they pick out marvelous things. That little rock-bound coast of Chicago was that French experience, you see. That's as light a touch as anything I ever saw. And I don't know who, they get together, and pick them out, and, you know, people. I never picked out anything for. I could have, you know, I could have suggested things. And,
but it's too bad that a whole.
And it's a whole lot better than the English departments. The English departments are dull, and English professors are, I don't know, they're screwball. I mean, there's something wrong with an English professor. I mean it. See, I've been one.
I was one.
But the C3 was different. You see, they had screwballs too, but in a normal sort of way. they seemingly, old Wash Clark was one of the finest spirits I ever saw. Old W.A. Clark. Did you ever run into him? Well, he was here a long time, and he used to sit back there and come out and beat Dr. Wise right there in the whole staff meeting, and Dr. Wise would stand up there, you know, solemn, like just waiting for him, giving him time to say what he wanted to, and then he'd proceed to sort of cut him down. It was all manipulation, all play acting, you see. But it was nice. It was good spirits. Now I can't. You see, when I joined that, I was against it. I came here and I was allergic to it. And when I was asked the first time I was given an assignment, C3, I thought the bottom had fallen out. So you see, I was in no humor to be the chronicler of it. The less I saw of it, the better. And it just came to me little by little, you see, what it was. And as I look back now, you see, I don't think anybody could have been duller and more addlepated than I was most of my time here, as far as the staffs up there were concerned. They had some, well, you know what they're like. But they're all remarkable people. Most of them are just remarkable people.
It's interesting, though, and you know,
it ought to be able to somehow take down the telephone and listen to the whole thing, a little bit of it.
I just stopped by one of the bookstores today, and there on the counter was a whole row of that Vanderbilt Group guy.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. Donald Davidson. Of books and things, and I thought, what personalities they were. He's talking about the person, you know, the
mm-hmm.
people in the city. Ah, they're lighthearted. They are,
mm-hmm.
you know, Mrs. David, Freddie Ben, and
mm-hmm.
Bill Bradshaw,
mm-hmm.
and Daddy, and the whole bunch. And they weren't in a mold. And there's a whole bunch, just in a row.
And you see, it ought to be offhand and casual. You don't want to make it heavy. Got all those pieces. You know one of the lightest pieces that ever was written? Isn't this little thing right here? This is our first statement, and nobody ever reads it and knows that it is a statement. No, I've never seen it done. I remember the whole beginning as a succession of flights and drops. A little seesaw of the right throbs and the wrong. That's the governess. Except it's not the young governess. I remember the whole beginning. That's the older governess recalling what it was when she was there. And that's the thesis that he pursues. As a diagnosis, you see, the whole thing. But nobody ever thinks of this as a thesis that's been worked out. Just mechanically. And then for the first few pages, he gives you those right throbs and wrong flights and drops. And what that is, you see, is a statement of the Freudian view. And now you see, you can't find anybody over there, from the professors on down to the freshman. If you say, well, now this Freudian business, I think that's something everybody ought to know. For instance, you see, for one thing, you know, everybody's got those suppressed desires, and they ought to be aware of that. And then, it's possible also, you see, to, you know, watch out, you see, you'll be schizoid and have a split personality and all like that. Well, you see, that's not Freudian. That's an illness. Freudian is psychology, not illness. You see, the psychology part of it is that she's nervous. That's all there is to it. Well, that's not all there is to it, but that's a basic statement. Other things go along with it. And it would be interesting to look at it and see yourself being froggy. You didn't expect that.
Anybody around here who's got flights and drops. Rick weren't stepping in quite as lightly today as you did yesterday.
No, I feel like him and Bricks up here hearing her.
Rick! Debbie, see what you do to us.
That's the cutest thing.
She's worse.
My mother laughs worse than I do. It's inherited. She tells me every time she sees me, it's inherited. There's something wrong in my hand.
Rick, line out that little meeting over there for Debbie. She missed that.
Williams?
No.
Oh, the town council. Oh, yes. My beloved town council. They organize. My God, are they organized. Troy has graduated from the brown and yellow leather boots to a complete suit.
Yeah.
Blue, with a printed shirt and a nice red tie.
Now, you don't need to ask who they are. He's telling you as you go along.
I wasn't asking anything. I had my mouth shut. Go ahead, Rick.
He got elected on the council. Oh, I guess it's been sometime this year, and just ended up in the chairman seat. Never intended it. Just took it over for the time being. Now he's it.
And well, he was practically it all that other time, wasn't he?
Yeah. What did it? He bought a briefcase. Big, square, tan briefcase. And every meeting it's there in front of him.
Yeah.
So he's added to the briefcase, so he's got a big cigar. And they used to use an old piece of pine board for a gavel. Troy's got a fine mahogany gavel with a shiny brass band around it.
Yeah.
So there was Troy sitting up there, and the new town clerk, who always dresses so nicely, and is just as neat as she can be.
Yeah.
And since she's taken over the town clerk's office, why, they've got bookshelves up there with books on Florida law and records, and everything's been put in order. And they found out how many records they don't have, that never were kept, that don't exist. She's got a machine to mimeograph, and they mimeographed a whole stack of agendas for the meeting. I guess there maybe were 10 people in attendance. They must have had 50 agendas left over. And then when they passed them out, they had told us to write in items 6 and 7, unfinished business, and new business. All of the agendas they printed. And the other side of Troy was Ms. Myers. She's just been elected. So she was just dressed in a nice pantsuit top. And then the mayor.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
They just been coming in their work clothes.
Yes. They always just came in khakis and old dirty shirts, just like they just got off from work and just could make it in time.
Except Troy. He's
the one that would dress. He started out in the double knit pants. They'd always bulge because he put too much in the pockets and they stretch. And then there was Walt Ebling on the end. And Walt's got a tie, and Walt wears a tie every meeting whether he's on the council or not. But he had his black zip-up boots this time, so he was real fancy. And then all the way over on the left side, 3 or 4 seats away from everybody, on the very end, and all by himself, was Hilton Herring. His old gray jacket and his old khaki work pants and work shoes. He just sits there by himself and his face is all scrunched up. And they call him the mole. That's what he looks like. So Troy started off with a gavel, just rap, 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 rap on his briefcase. I said, I call this meeting to order. We'll have the roll call. And this was printed out in the agenda. Call the meeting to order. Call the roll. And I said, town clerk, will you please call the roll? Troy Blakely here. Walt Ebling here. She goes on down the line. Eddie Glover wasn't there. Eddie Glover works for Franklin Creighton, while he drives a truck. And he's the only black council member.
Oh, is that what he does?
Mm-hmm. And when he does come to council meetings, he'll sit like this. Let's see. Put one leg out, arm down, like this, and he goes to sleep. Because it's the only time he gets to sleep. So there's a lot of abstained. When it comes to voting and you look at what Eddie voted for, he didn't show up tonight and he hadn't shown up in quite a while, in fact. Well, they caught the meeting going and they discussed the issues and then And they needed the motion. They turned to Walt because Walt has got a fine logical mind and can just phrase everything just so. So, Mr. Ebeling, would you like to make the motion? And Walt just smiles. Yes, I'll make the motion. I hereby move that this be voted on and all the steps be taken, etc., etc., etc. And the town clerk said they're just writing it all down the whole time. She, oh, I didn't quite get the last of that. Would you please repeat it, Mr. Ebeling? He'll repeat it. She'll write it all down. Well, that went along just fine until I got to the mayor's report. And the mayor had to go through something like a 10-page booklet from the federal government so that they would get part of the federal revenue sharing. And he picked up the book, and he looked at it and said, I have spent 40 hours at least this week on it, and I can't make any sense of this. And he slammed it down. Then he opened it up and said, I just want to read you something. Fill out line 12 according to paragraph C, unless this is different than part B of paragraph 2. In which case, go to line 5. And he said, now doesn't that read just like a W-2 form? Now, I don't know what to do with this. And Troy said, well, why don't you go by the records? We've got records of all those expenses, and you can just fill it in. He said, Mr. Blakely, there are no records. He says, well, sure there are records. Records are kept. Mr. Blakely, there are no records. And the mayor said, I just don't know what to do. And if we give it to our auditors, you know what they're going to charge us. See, they were trying to save money. So he said, and on the subject of these auditors, I'd like to move on and see about what's been found out about getting a new attorney. So now, I've been looking around, and I found a Mr. DePuca, who will be an attorney. He's young, and he's interested in civic affairs, and he's only $20 an hour. And everybody's, oh, this is fine, this is fine. He says, as you know, Allison Folds is a little bit more expensive. He's $25 an hour, and some of his decisions haven't been, well, I haven't just thought too much of them. And he gave an example and said that they have a problem. Their town clerk doesn't live in the town, so she can't be town clerk according to the charter. And he said, now my idea was we'll just make an exception on this case and vote on it. But Mr. Folds said we could appoint a town clerk in the town and then have her appoint a deputy clerk, which would be Marie, and then Marie would do all the work, but all the credit would go to this appointed clerk. I said, that's the damnedest thing I've ever heard of. So he said, I'd like to make a motion that we dismiss Mr. Allison Folds and hire this new guy. I said, we have any discussion on this? And Hilton said, yes, I don't see why we need a new one. So the mayor just leaned forward and looked at him and said, Mr. Heron, did you invite Allison Folds to the meeting last time? Oh, yes, sir, I did. He says, on what authority did you do that? I said, well, any councilman can do that. It's in the charter. The mayor said, oh, it is. So he picked up a charter, he threw it down on the table to Heron, and he said, where? Heron looked at the charter and goes, I don't quite recollect right now. I don't believe I could find it at the moment. So, Mr. Heron, why did you invite him to the meeting? Well, I think the attorney should be at all the meetings in case we need a ruling. He said, do you mean to tell me that you invited Allison Folds to this meeting to sit for 3 hours at $25 an hour for no reason at all? He said, yes, that's what I did. He said, Mr. Heron, why don't we just send you the bill? And Hilton said, well, I can pay it. Don't you think for 1 minute that I can't pay that bill? Then the mayor paused a minute. He said, Mr. Heron, since you've been head of the sanitation committee for all this time, and I guess he's been head of the sanitation committee for just years now, how many hours a week does McQuinney put in on picking up trash? I thought a minute. I don't know, but you know, they turn in their time every week. I think they're honest. We can go by that. He says, that's so. But we just don't know how many hours, do we? He says, well, no. He says, Mr. Heron, how many people pick up trash in this community? Well, I don't know that. Mr. Heron, have you been going to the Pollution Control Board meetings in this county to find out what we can do since we don't have a dump now? I said, I didn't know there were any meetings. And the mayor looks at him again and said, Mr. Heron, we asked you to get in touch with Joe Crevasse 2 meetings ago to find out about security patrols in the town. Have you been in touch with Sheriff Joe Crevasse? Hell, thinks a minute again, and he looks up. He says, well, you know, Joe Crevasse is one of those busy men that's just hard to get in touch with. You know, I tried 3 or 4 times. And about the time, Mr. Meyer out in the audience says, Well, you know, you never can get in touch with Joe. You got to go through his right-hand man. Hell goes on. And the mayor was just as mean as he could be. Oh, he looked tough. And he had his eyes wide open. And he said, "Miss Heron, I just want to thank you for being such a fine councilman. You have contributed so much to this council member. I don't know how we can get along with people like you, Mr. Heron. Thank you. That's all I want to hear from you tonight, Mr. Heron." And all the people in the council kind of shrunk down, and they're grinning and laughing and got their hands over their mouth. And whilst up there, this big grin, and then trying to move on to other subjects to cover it all up. The mayor won't let go, and he keeps thanking Mr. Heron.
You see more there in half an hour than you see in Sunday school for 2 months.
Oh. That is the first time that the mayor has spoken to any extent in all the meetings I've been. 6 or 8 meetings. It's the first time.
Well, you kind of expected that after this new reform ticket came in.
Yes. I was waiting for him to talk.
Yes.
And nobody will ever question the mayor. Even on that form. Troy was the only one to question him. And he finally just turned around and said, "Mr. Blakely, my opinion is, you see, they just keep putting these words in here like grant, money, and benefits. That's just a carrot. That's just a carrot, Mr. Blakely, in front of the mule."
Oh, Rick.
But Thelma wouldn't go along with him.
No. She... What happened with Thelma was... See, there's a moratorium they've been trying to put in effect for 90 days. Or until a survey can be made of the town to find out what kind of historic buildings and sites there are. And this is being done by Friends of the Library. Well, Friends of the Library is a society open to anybody in the town. It's just a good civic organization. Now, Mrs. Ebling, Walt's wife, is head of it. And so she was there that night with this proposal. And, oh, it must have been written by Walt, because she got up and wrote, "Whereas Micanopy is the second oldest city in the United States and one of the great historic spots, whereas it has some of the greatest historic buildings, etc., etc." She went on through about 10 whereases, then went to it. "Now, therefore, be it resolved that a moratorium shall be declared for 90 days or until a historic survey can be made." And Ms. Meyer's son was out in the audience, and he said, "Well, now, does this mean no building permit's going to be issued, and that I can't build the house that I was just about ready to build?" I said, "That's right." And he goes, "Oh, I see, it's it's his mother that's up there on the board." So they come up to vote. Well, they have a little more discussion, and Walt looks out and says, "Ms. Ebling, now, what do you mean by this 90-day moratorium?" And she gets a little flustered, and her voice fades out. "Well, that means that's how long it's going to last." "I see. What, you're going to conduct a survey now?" "Yeah, we're going to look around." And, of course, the whole time, Miss Ebling's standing there in this beautiful brown pantsuit and this lovely orchid, because they just had their 21st wedding anniversary. And he's questioning her harder than anybody he talked to all night. So she kind of laugh and giggle and try and make it light, and he was just asking these questions. And he finally let her go, and they brought it up for a vote. And Walt voted yes. Hilton abstained. And that left Ms. Myers. And she said, "Well, I got to think of my son. I vote no." So left it 1-on-1. And Eddie wasn't there to vote. So that meant Troy's vote was supposed to decide, but Troy's vote, since he's chairman, can only decide when the full council's present. So that meant the bill got defeated. And Walt just dropped his face, and Ms. Ebling just kind of sagged down and sat down again. But they were complaining.
But now Thelma didn't, she didn't perform.
And Thelma didn't do too much at all, just that one little bit about her husband performs more than she does out there in the audience.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he'll just speak right out. He didn't do too much last night. he did a nice show there when she got elected.
Yeah.
Because as soon as she got elected, she stepped out the door and told him, "Now you go get that election sign off the street before somebody steals it." Somebody poked him and said, "Ha ha! Now we know who's in charge, don't we?" And then he turns around and says, "You know, I was going to vote no, but she said vote yes, so I had to vote for her." They got to complaining about the money that was being appropriated every month. They appropriate $100 to, I think, some of it's given to the waterworks and some of it's given to the cemetery to keep the place trimmed, and some of it's given to Friends of the Library. And Troy complained. He said, "Now this money is just being paid, the checks are being issued without the council's approval every month." And the mayor said, "Well, you know, that's been going on an awful long time. We know where the money's going." Troy said, "I know, but the principle is the council ought to have control of its money. And we shouldn't be giving money to the Friends of the Library, even though it's going to a good cause, unless we approve it every month. We have to know where the money's going." The mayor looked at him and said, "I'd like to just have a little show of hands here. Who are members of the Friends of the Library?" Everybody raised their hand. So then they voted on the appropriations. Everybody voted to go ahead and appropriate it. And then they got to Troy. He said, "No."
I don't believe anybody expected Mayor Thomas to be quite as sharp as that.
No.
I remember the first time I saw him up there, you know, it looked like he was about to swallow his tongue. I remember, don't you know, Mr. My old friend that we used to talk about, Governor Wallace.
Morgan.
Mr. Morganson. He was raising that point of order, you see, as to whether or not that was legal, whether or not they could legally have that meeting of the council was legal.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be published a certain number of days and all like that. And that was a great big issue. And he didn't seem to know what to do with it. He did a lot of mumbling up there and deliberating, and nothing ever came of it. But now, Brother Williams, now he's in speech.
Don Williams.
Huh?
Dr. Don Williams.
Don Williams. He comes the closest to what we do.
Yeah, he does. He does. In fact, everything he read that proposal, and he's the only one that's ever tried to state back what he read.
Yeah.
And most of them say, "I didn't understand your proposal," but he just tried to say what he thought he'd read.
Yeah.
I thought how nice it was. Here's somebody to tell you what they read. I didn't have to prompt him. He said, "Now, as I see it, you want to study a way of living and preserve it and also show what you've learned from it, because you're working with a special place here and these people grew up under certain conditions that aren't going to exist much anymore." And he thought, you know, that's right. These people grew up with space. And he says, "I worry about what it's going to come to. It just isn't going to be with our urban living this kind of room anymore. And the people that aren't going to talk like they'd talk." He could see that. And he said, "Now, when you talk to them," he said, "you don't ask questions. What do you say? Do you say things like if they're going to talk about what's worrying them, do you say something like, 'Well, that must have been the most worrisome time in your life'?" I said, "That's precisely what we say." I said, "And maybe you'll just repeat something they said?" And I said, "Exactly." Mm-hmm. And that just keeps them talking, doesn't it? I said, "That's what would happen."
Keep it open.
And listen. And I said, "Yes. Out there they can talk, but a lot of them don't seem to want to listen to each other. But when you really sit down and listen to them, it's amazing how much they talk." And he said, "That's right. Now that's what I've seen." As it turns out, he's worked in Micanopy with him. And he said, "Now what I saw was that when people lived in what I call a closed world, that is, they don't move around a lot, and they don't know a lot about what's going on in the world, I find that when they talk about what they know well, well, it makes them calm and very secure and very self-confident. And he said, what I think is that when a person talks, they take their experience and they elevate it to the point of articulation, which is the same thing as me saying they examine their experience. Mm-hmm. I said, well, that's right. They're, and then I said, what happens is you can see them using their faculties when they elevate their experience to the point of articulation. Well, he had known a Mr. Peace. Mr. Peace was 92 years old, and he lived in the Canopy.
I went to Sunday school with him. Several years. He was the only good one.
Mm-hmm. And in 1899, Mr. Peace had worked in the phosphate mines for a couple of years over in Newberry, and there was a store there. And this lady worked in the store, and it was either her husband or her father, one that ran it. Well, for the next 70 years, he never saw her again, because the distance between Micanopy and Newberry, which is only maybe 10 miles. So he arranged to take this 92-year-old man over to see this woman. She's 96. He didn't tell her that. So he went by, and he talked to the daughter that took care of the woman. She said, now don't make an appointment, because as sure as you do, when that day comes along, she's not going to feel like talking. Just bring him by any time, and I'll tell you if it's a good day. So he just got Mr. Peace up one day and took him over there, and it was a good day. So he said, I sat there on the porch and watched him, and I thought to myself, here are two near centurions, and look at them talk. And he said they talked for almost an hour, just solid. And at one point in the talk, Mr. Peace was very confident that he was the oldest living man in the area. Asked her, he said, now just how old are you? And she said, 96. So they kind of took the wind out of his sails.
Yeah, Mr. Peace, when the last time I saw him, he thought he was afraid he wasn't going to make it to 95. And his sister reached 95. And you've heard two of them. And both of them were Methodists way back. As one of the, I was down here when one of the good preachers, Cora's, Flora's friend, I didn't know it then, but he had a following in that little circuit. Micanopy's on the circuit. And he had come back for this little revival or occasion, anniversary or something. Whole place rutted down at Watkins, you see. I remember Miss Peace and his sister in particular was so excited she didn't know what to do. She saw all those old Methodists flocking. I tell you, you see, so much of our life is just going to waste, you see, just gone, just gone. You get all this remarkable things, you see. And one reason is the people who have the gifts to do it have to work on masterpieces. They can't condescend to talk about Mr. Peace or Mr. Mm-hmm. MacWeaver. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the masterpieces are inaccessible. They just write to each other, you see. Mm-hmm. And there's very little you can learn from Milton. I worked on Milton. I put in maybe an hour on Milton. And that's what you do. Milton or Mr. Peace. I'll take a little Milton and a little Mr. Peace. I'll take the minor forms. What I'm talking about, see, that's what I call the minor forms. Because what you'd work on him in, you see, it wouldn't be an epic or Samson Agonistes or anything like that. See, it wouldn't be tragedy. It'd be a minor form. Mm-hmm. But still, it would show what goes on in the country. Now, you see, like Rick's account of the town council. That's what's wrong with that. That's art. What is art? It's whatever you use. What's the meaning of a word? What's in the dictionary? It's not the meaning. No, sir. That's not the meaning of a word. The meaning of a word is what's in your mind. That's the only possible meaning it can have. Think about that. I've just been using that a week now. You see, we ought to make something out of it. What you do?
A week.
Just since you've been out here. Not that long. I guess what I was thinking about is something Debbie did. I forget which one it was. That was before she did the little piece on the chart.
That was Candy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, now Mark Twain has a travelogue, you see, in Innocence and Roughing It.
And you said you felt that was minor form, a minor form.
That's a minor form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just coined the little term.
Just transferred it.
To cover what Rick and Betty are doing. Minor form.
Yeah, that's what all of us are doing. Well, it came up. It's constantly coming up, you see. I mean, it comes up partly because we try to formulate some of this grant business. By the occasion. Well, I don't imagine Moss would really be able to help you much.
He can't.
And he can't help you formulate it.
I don't think there's a busier man on campus. I found out today. You know, he spent 40 hours on campus Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I may as well just buy him a sleeping bag and let him stay.
Yeah.
He's just worn out. And see, he has no choice but to go as hard as he can go for 9 months. Because what I found out, I kind of cleared up, that Humanities Council is informed it's just being planned.
Yeah.
And they've got 9 months funding to do it. So he's got to go as hard as he can go to get it done. And I guess what he was hoping was that the proposal we gave him would be kind of ammunition to help develop the program and ask for more funding. But of course, it didn't work out quite like that. In fact, he let his secretary work on it, and she didn't understand it. She was looking up references and to find out who would be likely to fund something like that. Well, he shouldn't have let her read it because she doesn't know. So he turned it over to Dick Green, and I have to get in touch with Dick Green next week. He's in Texas right now, trying to do away with all English deposits or something like that. He said. So I got some more names that people have traced down. But, he tickled me. He said, I got my Christmas holidays reserved. I said, are you going to take some time off? He says, no, I'm going to do my own research. And then he says, that's what happens. It gets all relegated to Christmas holidays. And he said, I guess what this Humanities Council mostly is for, he says, simply is just to help bring more understanding and more appreciation of the faculty and student experience. I couldn't quite make sense of all what he said.
Most?
Mm-hmm. He looked like he was just pressed for time today. I didn't even get a chance to sit down. But it did hit some good information with Wayne Daniels.
Oh, did you see him?
Yeah. Oh, he's got his Bachelor of Arts and framed up there, and his Master of Education up there. And then this Wayne Daniels carved out of wood sitting on the front instead of just a little printed nameplate. And it's three-dimensional, you know. Oh, it's nice. And he just finished talking to some television equipment salesman.
And I said, it looks like you got a lot of people coming in and out here. And he said, well, we're getting ready to buy $42,000 worth of TV equipment. So I got a lot of salesmen around right now. So I talked to him about storing tapes, and I said, you know, we have some problem because some of them got mildew on them, and they're not in a real good storage place. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I just bought $9,000 worth of cassette tapes. So the Scotch representative will do about anything at once. So here's his card, and I'll get in touch with him and see what we can find out. And I asked him what kind of, you know, tapes, the life of tapes. And he says, well, now, they don't last forever. I told him what we use, and I said, we use 111 some. He said, that's a pretty good tape. I said, we use 141. He said, well, that one will get brittle in about 10 years, or a little less, because that's acetate. The other ones have a plastic backing, which is a little better. And he said, now, I can get these tapes for you through our contract. And they have a state contract, and they buy direct from 3M. So what they do is that 3M's plants in Atlanta, that's on I-75, and we're on I-75 too, so they just load up the truck and send it down, guaranteed 3 to 5 days delivery. And he buys a 111 that retails for $4, and they buy it for $1.24. And they buy the 202, which is a real good tape. That's a Dynarange series. It's supposed to have more frequency response than that. That's $4.75, and they buy it for $2.33. And so what you can do is, he said, don't buy any more tapes on your own. I'll buy it, order them, and then you just pay me. And I'll write the bill up, and then it just gets lost in the shuffle, and no one will just know quite what happened. Of course, no money lost. Right?
Well, last time I tried, the Tallahassee was buying all their tapes.
Uh-huh.
And they were buying the sort I didn't want.
Yeah.
So I didn't go with them. I could have got them. Just got him.
Yeah, apparently he can buy any kind. He just had list after list of all kinds of stuff. But he's that Scotch representative. He'll get in touch with them and find out what to do about the mildew and what effect it'll have on the tape.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to watch because it will damage them.
What,
although not right away.
What they do. They just have it back and forth all the time as who's going to spend the money, Tallahassee or the local people. That's
yeah.
All over the state. So
it's amazing the way that Washington spend. You know, they've all got the nice telephone to begin with, and then he'd get a call and say, well, look, I've got an IBM Selectric typewriter ordered. What else do you need? And he's got just some of those beautiful tape recorders around, and you know he's buying all this equipment. Complaining because they got $13,000 cut from his budget. He's going, oh. Oh, they spend it. You know about that. Where you
mm-hmm.
work, they spend it.
Mm-hmm.
They get a budget, they spend it.
If you don't spend it, they won't give it to you the next year, so everybody spend it.
Yeah. But that's well, now let me see, Rick, what are we going to do? I think we better just sit down something and just get it in circulation. We'll get that jigger over there, that directory, and just send a copy of it.
Yeah, Moss said before what I turned into him, he said he read through that and said before that circulated, you need to sit down for maybe an hour with somebody and just work on it a little bit. But as far as I see it...
Well, that's it. Sit down with somebody or something.
Yeah.
To find that somebody or something.
I think Moss
would. They haven't found it so far.
I think he would. It's just catching. December is apparently a bad month for everything.
I don't think Moss has been able to get his wits together and...
He looks like he's about wore out, really.
See, even before he started this, he was... See, he's such an agreeable fellow. And there's so many punks over there. So he gets more than his share, see, likes.
I think William's the big one. Sure. But I guess when you ask for money, you really got to give him a reason.
reason. You give them their reason.
Yeah.
Because they turn it over to their secretaries and they can't read.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're stuck with those secretaries.
Yeah. Some you just I guess you just play your chances for a good secretary.
Yeah.
Some of the secretaries don't have them.
Yeah.
Not all of them. They used to be, Debbie, the secretaries used to be. That's what made it possible to live up here when the last 10 years with Archie, you see, you had Mrs. Simpson in there. Remember that?
Never met her.
Dean Simpson. Right. I guess that's about the thing that we ought to do. Just about.
Oh, I found out that Proctor doesn't have anything to do with the humanities grant. Moss didn't even know what he's doing.
Hmm.
So that must be a different grant entirely.
Yeah, well, that's good.
He tickled me. He was just kind of sheepish today, like he hadn't done his homework.
Yeah. Yes, I've seen him like that. I've been like that.
And he's got up on his wall, he's got this, it looks like a kind of sign that we've gone on battalion headquarters or something in World War II, and it's this old piece of like newsprint, and it's got the black silhouette of a tank, it looks like it's done in black tempered paint, and how is it pronounced, Salaire Leger, Charlure, and I thought, wow, this must have some great war memories behind it or something, he's probably just heisted this in France from some commander's tent, great symbol, and brought it home and framed it. So we went home and looked it up, and I think what it means is light pay, heavy tank. It looks like a big joke. Oh, dear.
We can knock off something that will circulate.
But Williams, here are some of these things that you've done, just a choice piece or two.
I don't know that he can help you very much, Faye. Huh?
I was going to say, I got an appointment coming up Monday sometime with Alice Murphy. One of the great
speakers. Oh, did you ever get in touch with Shaw?
Yeah, I got him today.
To see that woman?
Yeah, I'm going to have to get in touch with her Monday.
Yeah. You tried, but didn't.
I haven't been able to get her. I haven't been able to get a hold of Shaw.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
I got him today.
Yeah. Well, now, when you call her, then you can't get a hold of him. You leave word that you call.
I do. Yeah.
So that lets him hold the bag.
Yeah. He was having trouble getting in touch with her. Because she's way out on 441 somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Towers building somewhere. Some office building down there.
Yeah.
But she's back. Ms. Alexander, the librarian, was sick again today, so I have to wait on that. And Ada Corbeau was out too.
Yeah.
The other librarian.
Those are the names that Rick said. It's me.
Don't ask me who they are.
You need to know more people on campus than anybody.
Following the news.
I don't quite know what to do, Jane. You see, the only time I don't want anybody underfoot except a limited amount of time, because I got to keep moving too. I just want to see them. If I see them, I don't have to speak. Most of the time, you see, I just don't want to interrupt what life charge I have. And I think you have to, I have to protect myself like that. And Jane hadn't had too much experience working at it, and she is the world's worst at talking. I mean, she can squat like an Indian and just tie you down indefinitely, see. And I'm not a great talker. I'm talking now because I'm learning something. And this is not talking like she talked. Mm-hmm. This is another sort of talk. She can capture. She's one of the few people, young people, who has been able to make something off the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she knows the young people and the adults. And she can, she knows when she talks to them, she gets them. I don't know how she does it. She's, you see, she's not too far along. She's,